To know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Serious. Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is having like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown Triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Horseshoe Vegas. About 55 minutes, and then I've got to somehow go back upstairs to the room. It didn't occur to me as the month, I've been gone a month. When I planned this trip, I thought, okay, be a week here, week there, week here, go there, come back to New Orleans, back to, it really did not occur to me how long I would be gone. It's one thing when you say, all right, I'll be gone, you know, 4 weeks, and then go be gone 4 weeks. So somehow, and I did not add to the wardrobe that I can tell. I mean, I got a t-shirt. Like, I think I got two t-shirts. Yeah, I didn't, sometimes I'll acquire stuff on the road, but I really didn't add much, and yet the suitcase is like so swollen, and I've got to do something. I will say this, I did time the dry cleaning and the laundry perfectly. Last pair of underwear, and there are actually probably a couple of pairs of socks extra that are clean in the suitcase. Otherwise, everything else, everything. I wore the shirts that I had dry cleaned in California, timed them, laid them out perfectly. So I did all right on that front. But somehow I've got some packing to do before we head to the airport. John White is with us, hanging in, listening to my insanity. John, good morning.
The time change and how rough that was on the horse players, and it brought back a fond memory for me, because when I was growing up, my father, he was such a dedicated horse player, and for him the real fun was handicapping the races the night before, getting that racing form and marking it up with his red pencil. And I remember so often he would say that he absolutely loved it in the fall when we got the time change, because it gave him an extra hour to read the racing form on a Saturday night. And he hated it in the spring because of losing an hour to read the racing form. So that brought back that memory. And I did want to congratulate you for Colgate getting into the March Madness. So we'll see how they do. I'm excited about Gonzaga. My wife's excited about Kentucky, although they've had such an up-and-down season that I find it hard to believe Kentucky can spring together a bunch of good efforts. They play a good game and then a bad game and then up and down. But Gonzaga, I think, could make a serious run in this tournament. And So, and you were talking about the future plays, and I was interested in your reaction to Skinner, because that was the one play that I did make in pool five. I put 100 on Skinner at 45-1, because that horse really scares me in the hands of the outstanding trainer, John Sheriff, a guy that can point a horse for a race like the Kentucky Derby and have him at his absolute peak on that day, like Charlie Whittingham. So, and of course, I'm excited still with the $200 on Practical Move at 83-1. So that's what's made this season of future wagering really exciting for me.
Well, and it's funny, John. I couldn't remember who it was that had mentioned Practical Move and getting him at that. Somebody else over the weekend when we were talking about the future wager, and somebody else had Practical Move. And it'll take me a second to index through who it was, but somebody else was excited that they got Practical Move, and they may have actually gotten Practical Move at Circa or at Wynn or one of the books here, but there was somebody else that is very pleased. And I got to tell you, based on this price this week even, I thought that was a decent number. Where is it? From that, even 12-1 on the pool over the weekend. I mean, if he comes back and performs again, he's going to be second choice, assuming Forte, everything goes as planned for him. Right? Practical Move. If you had to make the Derby line today, let's say it was Saturday, what's Forte and what's Practical Move for you?
Well, I would certainly make Forte the clear-cut favorite, because he is the clear-cut favorite. And at this time, I mean, something in the neighborhood of 5-2-ish, 3-1, because remember, it is a 20-horse field. And then I would probably make Practical Move the second favorite, but I'm not 100% sure because of all this hype with Tapitrice. And Tapitrice getting so much play in this future wager at 8-1, which, you know, I don't certainly feel is merited in my book. I mean, I wouldn't touch Forte at 3-1 this far away from the Kentucky Derby, because you're likely to get that kind of price on race day. And if he scratches on race day, you get your money back. If he scratches on race day and you played him in the future wager, you don't get anything. So, I mean, this is not the time to be playing a 3-1 shot or a 4-1 shot. And Tapitrice doesn't really have appeal to me at 8-1. I mean, if he was 40-1 or something, yes, but not, you know, I think you articulated it very well. And with Rich Migliori too, because he is such a quandary at this time. I mean, you don't really know what to make of him, but I really feel with his learning curve that's still ahead of him and his running style that, I mean, he just doesn't really fit the winner of a Kentucky Derby. I mean, yes, Rich Strike came from the clouds last year, but that has been far the exception than the rule. And I mean, like Rich said, I think he put it well that this horse still has learning to do, and we can all see that. I mean, there's tremendous talent there. There's no doubt about that either. So you always have to respect talent, and so you have to respect them, and certainly the bettors respected him in pool five here of the Kentucky Derby future wager by making him the clear-cut second favorite. But if, you know, if I were to bet a head-to-head, I would love to get a better price in a head-to-head against Tapitrice right now in the Kentucky Derby with Practical Move, because Practical Move, you know, posted a 100 buyer compared to that 88 for Tapitrice. And beyond that metric is the fact that Practical Move's got more of a kind of a tactical way of being in the race early, much more than Tapitrice. So, I think you're right. 12-1. See, I think really in reality, that Practical Move's the one that should have been 8-1, and Tapitrice would be more like 12-1 maybe, or 15-1. But, you know, it's what if, you know, the fact that he won on the, you know, the day before the pool closed, and he's fresh in people's minds, and, you know, he sold for so much money, and he's in the hands of a Hall of Fame trainer, and you know, that was visually impressive what he did. And I really thought his gallop out was even really impressive considering, you know, but he, you know, I certainly don't think that was exactly a tremendously strong field that he'd beat in the Tampa Bay Derby either, to beat as kind as I can to the vanquished.
No, and that's fair. There's also the mile in a 16th. So he's got, you know, we got to see him stretch yet another half furlong. Not that that's a big deal, but and he's a tappet, and there's plenty to recommend this horse. Nobody is saying when they question, you know, how viable he is looking ahead to Derby, but he would be asked. You know, not that any of them aren't being asked to do a lot in a you know, fairly short period of time. It just feels like. It feels like he's got to get a lot faster, quite quickly, and we'll see. I mean, I suppose if he could get into the mid 90s using the buyer scale, you know, let's say in the bluegrass, that might put him in good stead. I certainly don't think Todd wants to pull a Danza with him and. You know, train up to Derby from this point.
No, I think that he definitely wants to give him another race, which makes so. But this brings up something I've brought up before, and that Steve Haskin has talked about, and others, that, you know, what has made the Kentucky Derby rather difficult for many of us that are long in the tooth is you go back in the day, and we had established form on these horses. I mean, look at Secretariat a half a century ago, for Pete's sakes. I mean, that horse was the horse of the year as a two-year-old with a robust campaign, and then, you know, ran quite a few times as a three-year-old going into the Kentucky Derby. And, I mean, you would look at the past performances for the Kentucky Derby, and, you know, you saw 10, 12, 15, 16, 18 races. So we had an idea of what we were dealing with. Now we're having to project, you know, what we're dealing with on these horses. They're so lightly raced. I mean, look at Taba last year going into the Kentucky Derby with a maiden win and a Santa Anita Derby win under his belt. And I mean, that's becoming more of the rule where these horses are just so lightly raced going into the Kentucky Derby. And when you don't have, my dad used to hate maiden races because he hated it when there wasn't the established form. He loved like the last race on the card, which was $1,000 claimers in the 10th race at Playfair Racecourse in Spokane. And these horses had run 40, 50 times in their careers. And I mean, that's what he loved. He loved those kind of races. And I remember walking into Yakima Meadows one day in the spring, and there was a two-year-old quarter horse race for maidens going 350 yards. And I said, Dad, the lock of the year is running in the first race today. And he opened up his form and he said, what? He said, nobody's even run. And you're calling it the lock of the year? I said, yeah, the lock of the year. I'm telling you right here. And it was a horse called Dekella. And she won by like, it was at 350 yards. She won by like two or three lengths at about 3 to 5, 4 to 5. My dad said, how in the world could you be that confident in that horse? And I said, well, the dam had produced like something like 8 foals, and this was the 8th one and to have raced, and the 7 previous ones had all won their debuts.
Wow.
And like 6 of them had been stakes winners.
Wow.
And I mean, this was like, and she's famous, the dam is famous in quarter horse circles for being such a prolific producer. But I used to, once I kind of realized what we were dealing with this broodmare, I focused waiting for her offspring to make their maiden debut at Yakima Meadows in the spring. And so that's why I said, you know, and I said, look, Dad, it's 350 yards, it's quarter horses. If she gets wiped out leaving the gate, you know, and that could always happen. But I said, if she breaks okay, which I expect she will like her siblings, and she doesn't get wiped out leaving the gate, she's a lock. And she was like, and he's just shaking his head going, I need more form than this. There was no form, and you're telling me it's a lock.
well done. I can tell you personally too. I one of the things, one of the best attributes on Thorograph of the sheets is the progeny reports, and when you're trying to differentiate, you know, who might be precocious, and you know, workouts will help. You know, we don't have workout reports for every circuit by any means. So what do you rely on? You got to have some piece of information, and seeing siblings or a dam, you know, you start with sire stats, first out winners, what percentage, and you look for something, you know, north of 15%, 14-15% and above. That's a helpful starting point. And then you know, when I look up and down, John, at the siblings, and I see single numbers as two-year-olds, you know, that to me is a precocious indicator. You know, looking at sprint distance and route distances, looking on the sheet number, and you know, that at least gives you a clue that there might be some precocity involved. Then you know, try to find a gate work. You know, 48 flat, 47 and 4 from the gate, something that shows that the horse is going to potentially break sharp, and that's enough to go on. You know, you fold in trainers, obviously, you know, trainer win percentage with firsters, that'll go a long way, or second-timers if it's a second-time starter. You know, there's ways to, you know, grab a handle onto something, and that's amazing. I mean, to have that kind of record of progeny success, amazing first time start stats.
Well, at Del Mar in the summer, with some of those 10, 11 race cards, and you get the 2 year old races. So I spend a lot of time on XBTV taking notes on the workouts. I mean, once I get the past performances for a card, I was keeping track of how many hours I would spend on all the work to make the boarding line at Del Mar. At Santa Anita, it's usually in the ballpark of like 6-7 hours total for maybe a 9-race, 10-race card. But at Del Mar, it was going up to 17, 18, 19 hours for some of those cards, because the non-maiden races were very difficult too. You get 12 horses, and I would start at the top and say, oh, this horse looks like he's a contender, and then the next horse looks like a contender, and you go right down the line, and every horse could win the race, and you got to sit there. You know, I will sometimes on those races, in fact, I had one at Santa Anita over the weekend, where I jot down the top buyer speed figure for everyone in the race, and you'll get a situation where it's like, here are the top buyers for maybe like 8 horses, 68, 67, 66, 69, 70, you know, where every horse, their top buyer is within 2-3 points of the entire field. And yet they're not going to be bet that way. And so you got to sit there and try to figure it all out. But at Del Mar, with all that pedigree work and then the video work, I mean, it just piles on to how much time you have to spend on the card. But, you know, for instance, Practical Move, I can remember before his debut, he debuted against Cave Rock, and Cave Rock, you know, ended up the big 2-5 favorite in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. So he's debuting against a horse that was almost the 2-year-old champion, and Cave Rock won by 6. But I remember in the video work I did before that race that I thought, you know what, this Practical Move is not chopped liver here. This is a pretty nice colt. I also was taking into account how good the Practical Jokes have been doing. I mean, you know, this is a sire who has really done quite well. And so Practical Move, even though he went off at 24-1, he finished a respectable second in that race. And, you know, he's really improved and matured for Tim Yak Team. One of the impressive things about Practical Move to me was pointed out by T.D. Thornton in the Thoroughbred Daily News, and that is for the graded stakes races on the Kentucky Derby Trail on the road to the Derby, at the mile and the 16th distances, Practical Move has the two best raw times for mile and the 16th, and it reminded me of Al Havanother, how impressed I was when he pulled off the upset in the Robert Lewis at Santa Anita in his debut as a three-year-old, and he was a huge long shot that day, but his time and the way he won that race, I remember sitting next to Kurt Hoover, and I said to Kurt, you know, he was over 40-1 in this race, but there's nothing fluky about this deal at all. I said, this is a serious horse, and I ended up betting him in the future pool on March 1st. I was sitting next to Randy Moss in the press box at Santa Anita on Big Cap Day, which was one of the Kentucky Derby future pools, and they worked, I'll have another, between races, and he worked in 110 and change.
I remember that.
And it was the first workout I'd ever timed on a cell phone, and Randy Moss timed it on his cell phone, and we both had him in 110 and change. And I said, you know what, this horse is a pretty good price in the future pool. He was almost 30-1. And I walked right over to the mutual window in the press box here at Santa Anita and put $100 on him there after he worked that 6 furlongs. So, and you know, he was close to not even getting into the Derby. He basically had to finish first or second in the Santa Anita Derby to qualify to get into the Kentucky Derby. But he did win the Santa Anita Derby and, of course, then won the Kentucky Derby in Preakness. So, but this practical move, it's back in the back of my mind. How impressed I was with him in the video work before his debut at Del Mar last summer. And again, I mean, you talk about facing a tough opponent in your career debut, you know, have to come out and face Cave Rock in your debut. And the practical move has certainly moved forward. And another thing I like about practical move vis-a-vis the Kentucky Derby is I like that a Fleet Alex on the bottom. You know, you've got kind of the speed on top and the stamina on the bottom. And that's a secretariat type pedigree in terms of that stamina on the bottom. You know, one thing about secretariat, they kept saying, and if I had a dollar for every time somebody said, well, a bold ruler can't win the Kentucky Derby at about a quarter. I mean, I heard that a million times about the bold rulers. And but they were ignoring the bottom part of the pedigree that he was out of a Prince Quillo mare. And Prince Quillo was a tremendous source of stamina and breeding. And in fact, Sham, who, you know, might have been a Triple Crown winner in his own right if born in another year, he was out of a Prince Quillo mare, too.
How about that? I'd forgotten, you know, it's funny your reference. I do remember that work that you reference for I'll Have Another. And that's sort of lost to history. And the fact that he had to, you know, that he needed a placement to get into the field.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure is on. It's one reason I trusted Mario Gutierrez in terms of not choking in the Kentucky Derby, because Mario, there was actually more pressure on him to me in the Santa Anita Derby than in the Kentucky Derby, because if he screws up the Santa Anita Derby,
right,
he's not in the Kentucky Derby. So, I mean, he knew he couldn't screw that up. And so, and another thing I liked about Mario Gutierrez riding I'll Have Another from the 19 post in the Kentucky Derby, the only horse that's ever won the Kentucky Derby from post 19, is the fact that that guy rode at Hastings Racecourse, Exhibition Park, when I was a kid. But that's a tough bullring to ride. I mean, the stretch there is like 600 and some feet, and he won just a million races there. And a guy that is a very good bullring rider to me is a guy that can hold his own. You know, in other words, the quality of the riders at Hastings is nowhere close to the quality of the riders in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, it's sort of like the rider last year. I mean, he's riding against a much better quality group of jockeys than he does on a day-to-day basis. And so, I mean, the guy can ride without fear of some knucklehead doing something stupid during the race and cutting him off or something like that. So, you know, I really felt Mario Gutierrez was not a negative, as did a lot of people going into the Kentucky Derby. So.
Well, I was certainly one of those people, and not because, you know, not because there wasn't some quality to I'll have another, but I've told this story on Friday, Oaks Day.
The elevator story.
And yep. Gutierrez was going up to the press box on the sixth floor. That was before the room was turned into the mansion, and we were going up the press elevator, and they were taking him up for a press session, and he looked so wide-eyed, and you know, deer, the proverbial deer in the headlights look. I remember thinking to myself, Jesus, how's this kid going to handle this? And then he goes out and stands them on their ear.
Yeah, I remember when you talked about that at the time. And at first I thought, oh, no, because I had this future book bet on I'll Have Another. But I thought it through. And to me, I thought, you know what? I understand why he's going to look like that walking around, you know, in the grandstand area or in the elevator or whatever. He is going to be overwhelmed by being at Churchill Downs and so forth. But by the same token, you know, I play basketball, and so I know as an athlete, once I got on the court, any of these types of distractions kind of took a back seat.
There you go.
And for to me, Mario, once he got a leg up on I'll Have Another, his friend who he'd been, you know, riding, and he goes out on that post parade, and that's what he does for a living. And so, in other words, and another thing I've kind of learned is that a jockey actually might have a better chance to not screw up his ride in his first Kentucky Derby than later, because sometimes they don't really fully appreciate the magnitude of the Kentucky Derby. I mean,
right.
They know it, but once you're in it and you go through My Old Kentucky Home and all that, those jockeys then, it's like, oh my gosh, what a huge deal this is. I mean, once they experience it, I think there's a better chance of them choking the next time because of the fact that now they really know how important it is and what a big deal it is. So, you know, sometimes these jockeys, when they just haven't been in it before, they just kind of go along and ride a race like they would any other race because that's what they do on a day-to-day basis.
The John, a couple of thoughts about some of the other races, and probably you'll get a hold of Brad Cox this week. Feels like this was a very clever move to send Amore out to Santa Anita for the Beholder Mile, and what a ride by Flavian Pratt to nail Fun to Dream on the wire. I mean, there was not a stride that he could have wasted. It would have cost him the win here. This was something to real Fun to Dream in, who looked the winner, you know, in deep stretch. That was something. And there was a number of people here who clearly had used Amore in the contest.
Yeah, I made Amore 5-1 on the morning line, and you know, this is one of those situations I wouldn't have been surprised if she got that down, or I'm not totally surprised she drifted up. She went at just a tick under 8-1. You know, one thing I was going to originally make her 4, and it didn't quite work mathematically, so I had to raise somebody somewhere, and one reason I chose to raise her from 4-5. Was because they haven't been pounding the Cox horses in here as much as they were for a while. So I thought, you know, the fact that the Cox isn't getting bet quite as strongly as he has in the past was why I went to 5, and that was borne out by the fact she almost went off at 8. She went off at $7.90 to 1. But you're so right about the ride, and, you know, we talked, you know, 3-4 weeks ago about what a slump Flavian Pratt was in, and I mentioned to you, I said, you know, something to keep in mind and to keep an eye on is that you know that at some point this is going to turn around for this guy. I mean, there's no way he's going to continue to struggle to get to that winner's circle like he was for the first several weeks of the Santa Anita meet. And I'm telling you, in like the last month, he's back in form totally. And I mean, he has made a huge move in the jockey standings. And, you know, you can see the confidence is there again. And it's really something to keep in mind when you're betting these races at Santa Anita. You know, he's well behind Hernandez, who has 44 wins, but Pratt now has moved into second with 22. Considering where he was a month ago, that's pretty good progress he's made in those jockey standings. Dottori is third with 19. Maldonado, who's had a terrific meet, at 16. Tiago Pereira has had just a marvelous meet himself with 15. And then Hector Berrios, one of my favorite jockeys. That guy is so good, that Hector Berrios. He's got 15. And I mentioned to you in the last week or two what a fan I am of Ramon Vasquez, and he's at 14. And then John Velasquez at 14. And Frey's been hot lately. He's got 13. So that's a pretty solid group there in terms of the jockeys. But Pratt is back.
It's, you know, it's interesting because when you think about, you know, that scenario, and I, you know, I see this, you know, hand-wringing over the slow start of for the year, it seems, for Joel Rosario. Joel, and it's not a new phenomenon that Joel, it seemed like he had kind of moved past it the last couple of winters, but there had been a very clear extended period where it was not surprising if you saw, you know, Joel kind of struggle early or seem, you know, less than focused. His best focused self early in a season. And so it's funny because, you know, here was Pratt where people were speculating, well, what's wrong with Flavian? It's like, nothing's wrong with Flavian. Nothing's wrong with Joel. I mean, Cy Young award-winning pitchers go out and get rocked for 6 runs in 2 innings. It's not, you know, you get a series of mounts that, you know, your confidence gets shaken. Who knows? I mean, it's ebbs and flows. These are, you know, these are human beings. Guys get distracted or, you know, aren't as, they can't necessarily be focused all 700 mounts all year.
Well, you used a phrase last week. He said, you don't have to be Kreskin. You don't have to be Kreskin to figure out that Flavian Pratt is not going to stay in that slump forever. And when you said that about Kreskin, you brought back a memory for me because my family actually went and saw Kreskin live at a theater in my hometown. And that was a very fun evening. It was very entertaining. So you brought back a good childhood memory for me for when we actually saw the amazing Kreskin in person.
You know, it's funny because it's a lot of people are going to hear that reference and not really know what it means, but when we were kids, in addition to seeing him on, you know, stuff like the Mike Douglas show, he used to like go around to small venues. I saw him in Manchester, Connecticut in the high school auditorium.
Wow.
You know, in front of like probably what, 2,800 maybe? And it was a big, you know, it was like a big deal. Kreskin's going to be in town. That was the era, John, when you'd get things like that and you'd get not so much the Harlem Globetrotters. We used to get, what was the second rate? That's not fair. There was sort of the beat, you know, the B team version of the Globetrotters with Marcus Haynes, the Wizards, the Harlem Wizards, and Marcus Haynes was their ringleader, like Meadowlark Lemon was of the Globetrotters, and they used the barnstorm and the King and His Court. You know, of course there was the horse named for the King and His Court, the four man softball team that would take on all comers. They would come into a town. Barnstorm, and there'd be the King and then 3 players in the field, and they would beat teams of 9.
Well, you talked about the small venues that Kreskin would play. That was the case for us because it was a movie theater that he did this at, the Fox Theater in downtown Spokane. And so, I mean, you know, we saw movies generally in that theater, but in this particular case, it was Kreska. And by the way, another fond memory for my family, what we did, I think my brother kind of caused this, my younger brother. He had become a big fan of the song A Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash. So we went to Gonzaga University, which, of course, is in the March Madness here. And but we went there to see Johnny Cash in concert. And I'll tell you, it was one of the best concerts I've ever seen. I mean, it was absolutely fabulous. So I feel lucky that I got to see that guy kind of at the top of his game, perform.
Speaking of top of his game, let's touch on a couple other performances at Santa Anita over the weekend, John. And I really should reach for George Papapodromou and get him on. Here's Bruce Chandler's homebred, the 5-year-old Spirit of Makina, who basically hounded Forbidden Kingdom and, you know, wins clear, wins well. Here's a horse that's now won 3 out of 4 races.
Boy, he's a serious horse, that's for sure. I mean, and he won this race with authority. I made him 4-1 on the morning line. And again, this was one of those cases I wouldn't have been surprised if maybe he drifted up. This was his stakes debut. He was facing much tougher competition here. But I wouldn't have been that shocked if he went down, and he did go down, you know, in the odds. So the public was on to him. And boy, Papapodromou has been really red hot lately. So has Steve Knapp. Steve Knapp had a horse yesterday that I had 10-1 on the line, and they bet it down, and then the horse drifted up to 4-1, and I felt a little better of having a 10-1, and then it was one of those last minute odds drops down to 2-1, and the horse won like he was Secretariat in the Belmont Stakes. So. But Papapodromou has been very hot, and he's got his hands on a real quality sprinter. There's a tremendous upside considering how lightly raced this guy is. And, you know, our sprint division isn't real deep here right now. So he should have he should be a horse that Papapodromou and the connection should have a lot of fun with going forward.
Agreed. And, I don't think the division, is bereft, just limiting it to the discussion to the West Coast. We're well, absolutely well in need of any emergent type. And this is a horse that showed up as a 4-year-old, not until, and here's another, not cautionary, here's an encouraging tale, shows up at Del Mar as a 4-year-old for his first start, wins 83 Beyer, comes back at the end of the meet, closing week, and just gets beat by Holden the Lute, who was in this the Mark Glatt Midnight Lute gelding, and then gets a little bit of a little light winter freshen, comes back in February and wins like a champ, and wins in his graded stake debut. There's a lot to like, and in fact, I think I've got the figure. 94, he actually, didn't need a bigger figure than that. Career best was the 98 that came in February in the allowance win. By the way, this also goes to show that, Joe Bravo, you can put Joe on a front runner or a horse that wants to, be near the lead. Joe thought of, I think, more generally as a guy that comes from off the pace, particularly when it comes to turf, to turf events and turf routing. Joe, a terrific off the pace jock, but here's here he is on a pace horse, he's now won twice, including the stake. So keep an eye on Spirit of Makina, and I will get George Papapodromou. For the most part, John, of Papapodromou with the Bruce Kretz horses, but it feels like he's attracted some new clients.
Well, he's had such success that that's not surprising. I mean, people are, you know, you start to do well and people are going to knock on your door. And so it's well deserved, this business expanding for him. We talk about kind of the lack of depth in the sprint division. As you correctly pointed out, even nationally, there is a sprinter that I think hasn't gotten too much attention, that he's gotten my attention big time, and that's a colt. He's an Into Mischief colt, a four-year-old, a Godolphin colt by the name of Strobe. And Strobe, in his career debut last year at Churchill Downs, went out there and won by 4.5 and got a 99 buyer as the favorite. And finishing third in that race was Elite Power, who may ring a bell, as that was the Eclipse Award-winning sprinter, male sprinter, winner of the Breeders' Cup Sprint, and, of course, an impressive winner over in Saudi last time out. So Strobe, who he's only lost once, and that was on a sloppy track. So he's 4-for-4 in his career for Brad Cox, and in all four wins, he's won by at least 4.5 lengths. And he just worked yesterday in New Orleans, so he had to work at Fairgrounds. And that Strobe, to me, when people want to talk about the sprinter situation nationally, to me, he's one to definitely keep an eye on, especially when he's already kind of creamed the horse that was ended up being the sprint champion last year.
Well, it's kind of a formative period with horses kind of emerging, coming back for seasonal debuts. I did notice, we talked O'Neill earlier. Just looking at my charts here from Santa Anita from Saturday and kind of absorbing some of the things that happened while the contest was flying around. And we also should talk, I'll turn to you in a second to bring up yesterday's stake as well. Nice to see Simon Callahan, who's been quiet. Nice to see Simon get a stake win, and there's that Flavian Pratt again with Ballet Dancing. But John, the Redham, not a homebred, but a Redham purchase that broke the maiden on Saturday. I don't get it. Broke a mile and a 16th that race, and that was, I thought, a pretty good effort. And I just checked the fig, 88 buyer for the O'Neill with Mario Gutierrez. That horse may find himself getting a stake debut.
Absolutely. That was because the runner-up in that race is a pretty nice sort in his own right from the Mandela Barn, Yellow Brick. And I don't get it for Redham. Certainly is one that looks on the upswing. This cloud computing colt. And so you're right. I mean, that is one. Now, something that we did have happen in Santa Anita on Saturday, we had a match race.
Yeah, that's right.
In the fourth race. And on the revised morning line, I made Vincenza 1-9, and he went off at 1-9. And I had a difficult time deciding what to make Saburo's Girl as the second choice. And I debated between 5-1, 6-1, and 8-1, and ended up going with 5-1. And at one point in the wagering, Saburo's Girl was 3-1. And I thought, well, mate, I guess I went too high at 5. And then Saburo's Girl drifted up and went off at 9-1. So, and I asked Frank Miramani, I said, have you ever called a match race before? And his answer was that he had called one that he had recalled, and it was a couple of mules up on the Northern California Fair Circuit, Sarah Nelson versus Smoking Joe. So this was Frank Miramani's first thoroughbred match race that he'd ever called.
That's pretty funny. The players, that was one of the unfortunate things weather-wise, losing the turf on Saturday, that kind of quashed a few of the players' ideas. Well, in addition to those performances, and we'll find out next time we talk to Doug O'Neill what's going on with I Don't Get It. The performance by Ballet Dancing, the mile and a quarter Santa Ana yesterday, John, and this was an interesting group. You had Duvet Day in there. I had Friday Christina Blacker on, and I asked her about Dan and Queen of the Temple. who came back in here out of the good effort in the Astra. They had been 1-2, Duvet Day and Queen of the Temple. But ballet dancing, I think, who you made second choice. You know, Australia Mia, Dottori pulled her up, right? I did not see an update on that.
I didn't see one either, so I'm not quite sure what happened there. But as far, it was nice to be back with some turf racing yesterday at Santa Anita, that's for sure. And in fact, we are bracing for yet another, maybe one of the strongest storms of our entire season, tomorrow and Wednesday. 100% chance of rain tomorrow and like 95% on Wednesday. And I mean, they're talking not just the sprinkle, they're talking major rain here for the next 2 days. Now, the good news is that the forecast is once we get past Wednesday, it looks like we're in for a pretty good long dry spell finally. So once we maybe get this, and thank goodness it's on Tuesday and Wednesday and not next weekend or something like that to pull the rug out again, because we lost the Friday card, of course. So, but ballet dancing, I think one of the things, I'm looking at my past performances that I marked up in making the morning line, and one of the things I circled was her entire career in terms of the distances. She'd never raced shorter than 1 mile, but she'd never gone longer than a mile and an eighth. So this was a case of stretching out to the mile and a quarter. And again, what a ride by Pratt. I mean, you can now see just he's riding with such confidence. And I mean, this filly didn't just win this race. She won, you know, with authority. And this is a case where she went off at a nice price after being the favorite in three consecutive races. She'd won one of those in the allowance race, but she'd been a beaten favorite in two of her last three. And she actually even turned the tables on Buzz of New York, who she beat in this race because she had finished behind Buzz of New York last time. So this is a nice filly with a good pedigree by Medaglia d'Oro out of an unbridled song mare. And this win certainly puts her in the forefront among the longer distance distappers that we have on the Southern California circuit. And there's plenty of those types of races for her to compete in.
Well, and nice for Simon, as I mentioned, who's been quiet. I just reached out to Michael W. McCarthy and got an immediate answer. Australia Mia is fine. Frankie was just being very precautious.
Well, and that's better to err on that front, that's for sure. So, but that was a really nice win by a sparkling win, really, by ballet dancing. And like I say, she figures to be a major player in these mile and a quarter. You know, she might even be a mile and a half type. And Del Mar runs those mile and three eighths types. I mean, you'd figure that would be a beautiful fit for her, those mile and three eighths stakes races that they have at Del Mar on the grass.
John White. I appreciate it. Got anything else from the weekend that I've got about 5 minutes to close out?
Well, I also wanted to just say that a passing of a outstanding champion in Extra Heat that we found out.
Thank you. I'm glad you slipped that in. Go ahead.
And I happened to be on the air on HRTV when she ran her final race in the Barbara Fritchie. And it was an extremely foggy day that day. You couldn't hardly see much of the race that day. Dave Rodman was just outstanding, as he always is. To me, one of the finest announcers we have in the game today, without question. And he handled that fog situation just like he handled everything so beautifully. She ended up winning that race under Rick Wilson as the even money favorite. I'll just never forget it, watching it, hearing Dave Rodman handle the fog. And in fact, they dubbed that race on HRTV that day the Barbara Foggy Handicap. And but what a tremendous mare she was. 26 career wins, so many grade one wins, graded stakes wins, and, you know, 35 career starts. And she did something that's extremely difficult to do, and that's get into the Hall of Fame as a sprinter. All you got to do is ask Kona Gold about how hard it is to get into the Hall of Fame if you're a champion sprinter.
I'm glad you brought her up. She was wonderful. And If I did I see what did I see that actually she had died in January maybe and
December
and word yeah. just got out and it happens that does happen frequently you know if they're not in a prominent spot that you know where somebody's like an old friend's let's say and it's even worse when you got horses that are abroad and you find out, you know, 4 months later, somebody, it's like, come on, why does that happen? How are we not hearing this sooner? But either way, it still gives us the opportunity to pay appropriate tribute. She was terrific. And Harry Vega, of course, right, the majority of
yes,
of the
yes,
lives.
Definitely, yeah. Absolutely. She was something special, and like I say, I really cross my fingers and hope the day will come where Kona Gold will get into the Hall
he
of
will.
Fame.
We're getting them in. We're gonna put on. Jay Pribman's gonna join us this week too, and we're gonna start our campaigning. get them in, John. Thanks so much. This was great.
Very good, Steve. Good to talk with you, and look forward to catching up with you next week.
I'll talk to you next week. We will come to you from, I'll be talking to you from Ocala.
As the travels continue.
It doesn't let up. Take care. John White, everybody. Post time, John, on your Twitter. I reached out to Keith Shamblin. Some years, Keith pops on with us and to kind of, you know, give the benediction. for the Vegas trip, but he actually hopped on the red eye. I said how Roger Satina red-eyed at home. So did Keith Shamblin. And I kind of was half expecting that you'd be down here with a coffee together like we have some years, but it was just me alone with the staff here in the event center.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. Got about 4 minutes to put a big bow on all of this, Keith. From the NTRA perspective, some thoughts on how everything went the last 3 days, 4 days.
Well, I thought it was in many, many ways our best NHC ever, Steve. We crowned a terrific champion. We had, you know, some drama at the final table. Just a great group of competitors. Of course, we had Francis Bustani led, you know, much of the first 2 days of the championship, and then our Paul came on strong and on day two and day three, and to put together days like that, pretty amazing, and just a great venue, great host with. And partners, Caesars Sports and Racebook, and the newly branded Horseshoe is well on its way to being rebranded and entirely renovated, and already looking forward to next year's event.
You know, there's some things about Paul, particularly that made him and are going to make him a very popular champion and the face of this year's NHC, that, you know, gets called on for, you know, some publicity purposes. The fact, Keith, that he, one of his two tickets was earned in a free roll, it's unbelievable. It's just amazing. There's six of them, basically. And then there's contests like the one we do, the Beat Bick. That's technically a free contest. But to beat 2,500 people in a pick and pray, and that be one of the tickets that ended up, you know, helping earn him, you know, $950,000 yesterday, it's amazing.
It really is a great story, and we're going to tell it and tell it and tell it until people are sick of hearing it, because you, like you said, you join the tour for $50 and you get an opportunity to play in those free contests, and to turn it into nearly $1 million is an amazing feat.
Well, he also, part of the appeal, I had some people at dinner on Friday night, and then I heard a couple other times, the average age is of the players is 57, and then I looked down on the sheet, and Paul Kalia is 57.
Yeah, I think, to me it's getting younger and younger, our group, maybe because more and more people are playing every year, but it seems like there were a lot of younger faces in the room this year, and that's exciting as well.
Agreed. And one of the things we did over the during the coverage, you talked a lot about the tools that are available, and the kind of the mentality of this next generation of player that may not have as much time or the inclination to do the what we would consider heavy lifting, honestly, of the long-term learning curve that most players of existing ilk that we all experienced, and they want ready data, a lot of cases AI aided, and if that brings them in, that's great. It doesn't matter how we how we get them here. That getting them here is the most important part.
No, and I totally agree. I think these younger players, even middle-aged players, are looking at the game entirely differently than they were maybe a decade or two ago, and there's so much available, so much data available through other sources nowadays that they're taking advantage of it, and it definitely gives them at least they feel like a real advantage over doping it out in the daily racing form, grinding out, trying to select a winner the way I always have and many others have. But that's okay. That's all right. And there's still people that do it the old-fashioned way. You love to hear people say that, I just like to get a form and get yep. the PPs in front of me and try to handicap a winner and pick a winner the old-fashioned way. And that's okay, too.
That was one of the real lessons of the entire weekend, again, that there's all different ways to derive a selection and to make money and be successful. The key is we hope that everybody that finds this an interesting avenue in the game, make it happen, join the tour, and at least sign up and then play, and we'll get you here to Vegas next year. Keith, thanks to you and Tom, Holly and Michelle and Casey and everybody. A phenomenal job behind the scenes. The players appreciate it so much. Thanks for having me, and looking forward already to 2024.
Take care, Steve. Safe travels. Don't let that forklift get you. I hear it in the background.
They're ready to move me out. I'm the last vestige here. Thanks a lot. Keith Shavlin, everybody. And there we are. We're done from Vegas. We'll send you out into the race day, and I'll be talking to you from home tomorrow, at least for 4 days before we head to Ocala. Thanks to Graham Motion and Carlo Vacareza, John White, and Rich Migliori as well. Have a great day, everybody. Bye from Vegas. 6 to 9 replay tomorrow on Sirius XM. Casey will have probably the Sunday stuff up as well today, and I'll talk to you in the morning.
Thought there goes a Buick 49, black sheep of the angels riding down the line. We think there is a soul.
At the races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? MassBreads get paid up to an additional 25%.